This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
Good evening. Erev Tov. We're delighted to see such a large crowd here, despite the weather. I think we're waiting to find out whether Jews are going to remain Democrats, and we're all waiting with bated breath. But before we hear from Professor Sana, I'd just like to give some thanks for this wonderful lecture series. First of all, I'd like to begin by thanking our lecturer, Professor Sana, for what has been an informative series, a riveting series, and has provided a lot of knowledge to all of us. So I'd really like to extend a big thank you. And I'd also like to extend a thank you to the Brettler family, Dina and Mark are with us this evening, for continuing to sponsor this event year after year as a dedication to their parents. Indeed, the dedication that they have to their memory and to Pardes is very warmly received. And we're really delighted that every year it's exciting to think about who the lecturer is going to be, what the topic is going to be, and to enjoy the lectures week after week. So really, thank you very much to the family. And I think it is a fitting tribute. I'd just like to draw people's attention to two future evening events which are taking place here at Pardes at the beginning of January. One is an evening with Professor Leon Kass, who some of you might be familiar with his work on the book of Genesis. And he's going to be speaking on the Ten Commandments. That's on the 2nd of January, Monday night, just like these. And on Wednesday the 9th, we're having a book launch of Daniel Gordas' latest book, A History of Israel. That everybody's invited back to attend. Tell your friends. There are flyer if you need a reminder, something to put on the refrigerator to remind you to turn up. We have flyers sitting on the seats, so take one with you and it'll remind you to attend the event. Wednesday the 11th. Okay, thank you. I don't have the flyer in front of me, so there you go. Wednesday the 11th. That's the Daniel Gordas book launch. So without further ado, we're going to move to the lecture, The FDR Coalition, How Jews Became Democrats, and Whether That Is What They Will Remain.
It's really a pleasure to be here. I'm absolutely shocked that so many of you turned up as I was walking here because I couldn't get a cab. I wondered whether there'd be a minion, and look at all of you. I'm very honored, and in Israel they call them Gishmei Bracha, so it's really blessed, a blessing, this rain, and you're clearly part of that blessed experience. And let me also extend thanks to my good friends, Professor Mark Brettler, Dina Brettler, who for being here and for making this possible in memory of their parents, whom I remember so well. Now, we closed last time with the 1928 election, won by the Republican Herbert Hoover. And in that election, as in many others, including the 2016 election, Jews voted differently from the majority of Americans. A clear majority of Jews, depending on which retrospective expert you like, it's either 63 or 72%. There are two different ways of calculating backwards some of those Jewish votes, voted, but they voted for the Democrat Al Smith, who was very popular in Jewish circles, while, of course, a clear majority of Americans generally, roughly 58% of them, voted for the Republican Herbert Hoover. Now, Al Smith was the first serious Catholic candidate ever to run for the presidency. He was a great favorite of immigrants, of all kinds. He was of mixed Irish-Italian immigrant stock. He grew up on the Lower East Side. He'd known Jews since he was a child. He even knew some Yiddish. And I believe that for the very first time in a presidential campaign, he made good use of the little Yiddish he knew to reach out to Jewish voters in much the same way that nowadays candidates who can speak Spanish to Spanish voters. Lots of Al Smith's advisors were Jews. Actually, his closest advisor was a woman named Belle Moskowitz. And that, too, is new. Belle Moskowitz was very well known in Jewish circles. And the whole family, Henry Moskowitz, part of that family, was known. We see the impact, of course, of the women's vote and of the emergence of women in politics in the Al Smith campaign. And he was close to lots of Jews, Robert Moses, who later sort of built New York, and Joseph Proskauer, the president of the American Jewish Committee. Indeed, if you go back and look in the Jewish newspapers, you'll see that the Jews believed that Al Smith had a Yiddish kop, as they say, a Jewish head, something not said, so far as I know, about any previous presidential candidate. Some rabbis, the most famous was the great Reform rabbi Stephen S. Wise, went overboard. Wise, who was a Democrat, said no one is a good Jew unless he votes for Governor Smith. Of course, that excluded one in three Jews from the Jewish people, since a third voted. And they were not small. I mean, Louis Marshall supported Hoover. Julius Rosenwald of Sears was a big supporter of Hoover. But nevertheless, I mention Wise's statement because it underscores the point I've been making throughout these lectures, which is how Jews moved over time from outsiders to insiders in American politics, and how their 19th century rhetoric of really anti-politics doesn't disappear, but it gives way over time to a very deep engagement with politics. And certainly some Jewish leaders, contrary to those commandments that we talked about, not the Ten Commandments, but the politics commandments. I have to come back to hear Lewis Cass to hear the Ten Commandments. The commandments of Jewish politics were really honored in the breach more and more as time went on, and we'll continue to see that. Now, for Jews, the 1928 election and Al Smith really represented a blow against the Ku Klux Klan and against all of those religious and ethnic prejudices of the 1920s. John Higham, the great historian, spoke of the tribal 20s. Those of you who know my work know that I argued that in some ways the period we're in now is similar to the 20s. A lot of American Jews think it's the 30s, but I think the 20s is a better metaphor. And Jews made a lot of money in America in the 20s. That's the good news. But I think that the Smith was a reaction to the hatred, and we saw some of that last week. There's nothing of that period. The hatred of Henry Ford, unhappiness at Prohibition, unhappiness at the very severe immigration restrictions that were imposed in a draconian way in 1924. poor. But the most significant thing for political scientists about the Smith campaign is that it pointed the way to a new urban coalition. Jews, Catholics, urban laborers, and that coalition was really what Al Smith pioneered. It didn't work for Al Smith, in case you hadn't heard. He lost. They used to say Al Smith was defeated by three P's: prohibition, prejudice, and prosperity. Those were the three P's that defeated Al Smith. Anti-Catholic supporters of Herbert Hoover, and I want to make clear, Hoover himself was a very decent person. He'd worked with Jews, central in post-World War I famine relief, but his supporters really did a lot of things we just saw in 2016 that everybody thinks is new. They put out a lot of fake news to defeat Al Smith. The amazing thing is people believed it. If you go back to the late 20s, to that election, you'll find the claim that Al Smith as president would annul all Protestant marriages. And but even more astonishing, and I mean, it's really defies belief that people believe this, but no, if you look 2016, maybe we understand it. The most astonishing claim in 1928 was that the Holland Tunnel in New York, which you remember Al Smith as governor had championed, contained a secret passage which would be used to transport the Pope from the Vatican to his future throne in the United States. If anybody finds any secret passages in the Holland Tunnel, you let me know. It really astonishing. But then, as now in the United States, fake news and conspiracy theories can win votes from among the disaffected. That, again, and it's parallel in interesting ways, was one of these elections where rural voters turned out en masse to ensure Al Smith's defeat. If you go back and read the pundits in 1928, they thought that the Hoover landslide would derail Democratic hopes for a long time. But that didn't happen at all. In 1932, just 4 years later, but of course a lot had happened, including the great stock market crash and America's entry into the Great Depression. 4 years later, Franklin Delano Roosevelt picked up the pieces from Al Smith's failed campaign and shaped a new coalition. It's often called the FDR coalition, although it's clear that Smith had begun working on it. That coalition, again, embraced Jews as part of a group of an urban coalition, and it's really a coalition that was central to the Democratic Party, really until the last election, when the last vestiges, bunches of Catholics, had abandoned the coalition some time ago, but the white workers vanished, much to Hillary Clinton's surprise in 2016, and I think it will be seen in many ways as the breakdown, the final breakdown of that coalition. Franklin Delano Roosevelt, like Al Smith, had very deep ties to Jews. I should say, for those who were here last time, of course, like Theodore Roosevelt, the name Roosevelt was magic already in Jewish circles, and we saw that last time. They're all on, if you weren't here last time, they're all on the web. FDR grew up in New York. He served as governor of New York, which, of course, means you know Jews. Then as now, New York was the most populous Jewish state. Roosevelt revered Louis Brandeis. He used to call him Isaiah. And he was friends with a very long list of other Jews. Indeed, his next-door neighbor in Hyde Park was Henry Morgenthau. But he knew lots of Jews, Rosenman and Hillman and Dubinsky, all very significant figures later in his administration. And it's worth knowing that FDR really handpicked his successor as governor of New York, and that was the first Jewish governor of New York, Herbert Lehman. Jews, you know, felt warmly towards FDR. And when FDR runs for president in 1932, he appeals directly to Jews, meaning he speaks out against anti-Semitic prejudice. He opposes Republican plans to register aliens. I hear that hasn't fully died, that idea. And there also were plans to limit immigration further, which FDR announced that he would oppose. FDR attacked prohibition, which Jews despised. They also widely, don't tell anyone, but they widely violated it. And FDR comes out very strongly in favor of Zionism, at least rhetorically. Most important of all, for Jews and for all Americans, it was very easy to win an election in 1932. He promised to improve the economy, and with the party in power usually loses when the stock market crashes, and record numbers of Jews and non-Jews were unemployed in the Great Depression, much more than in the Great Recession. They calculate the numbers differently, but as many as a quarter of all Americans were unemployed. So it's no surprise that FDR garnered about 70% of the Jewish vote with Herbert Hoover and the socialist candidate, Norman Thomas, some will remember that name, winning the rest. Now, FDR, in his first years as president, really wins the hearts of American Jews. He appointed dozens of them to high-level jobs, this at a time when many companies did not appoint Jews, and that was legal. And literally, according to some of the people who looked, Howard M. Sacker gives this number, that he appointed almost 5,000 Jews to jobs within the expanding bureaucracy, as you had all of that alphabet soup of organizations. The whole Washington population grows, the bureaucracy grows, and Jews were very well positioned to take those jobs. Lots of them had gone to college in the late 20s, early 30s. They couldn't find jobs, and now college-educated folks were welcomed by the administration. And it is worth knowing that FDR announced and made clear that he would not tolerate discrimination on the basis of religion. Reputedly, he said, and the fact that people believed he said it is more important than whether he actually said it, but he's reputed to have said that he cared as little about a man's faith as about the color of his hair, which was a fairly significant statement in the 1930s. And, of course, anti-Semites noticed all of these Jews moving into government offices, and that's why they dubbed the New Deal the Jew Deal, and they claimed that Roosevelt himself must be secretly Jewish. His original name, they claimed without a scintilla of evidence, was Rosenvelt. But amazingly, there were lots of people who believed that. You repeat it often enough, like saying somebody's not born in America, you repeat it often enough, and people believe it. And it was interesting. It was a hard thing. On the one hand, Roosevelt didn't want to say, no, I'm not of Jewish background, because that would sound as if he didn't want to be a Jew. There were various quotes attributed, but it was quite difficult. In any case, Roosevelt knew how to play to Jewish voters. He regularly, if you go back now and see Jewish newspapers online, Roosevelt understood. Every year he would send Rosh Hashanah greetings to the Jewish community, something that George Washington and Abraham Lincoln certainly did not do, but that now was an easy way to appeal to a Jewish audience. They'd regularly appear. And he went further than that. If you go back, you'll see that lots of Jewish organizations, the annual meeting of the Zionists, would get a message to be read from FDR, which had made a big impact. And he spoke out against intolerance. In 1936, when he ran for his second term, his opponent was a man named Alf Landon. Alf Landon was the governor of Kansas. Now there are more Jews in Kansas because all the Jews on one side of Kansas City moved over to the other side of Kansas City, which is in Kansas. If you read the statistics someday, a historian who doesn't know geography, think, wow, a big migration into Kansas. But actually, it was mostly Jews who moved from one side of Kansas City to the other side. In FDR's day, they were still in Missouri, and there were very few Jews in Kansas. There were some, but Landon didn't know Jews. Later, Landon was a very decent person. Later, he becomes a supporter of Zionism. But in 1936, the Nazi Bund, the German-American, that was the organization of German-Americans, it was pro-Nazi. We now know that at least some members of the Bund hoped to invade the United States and tried to organize it. That Bund publicly supported Alf Landon. And because they publicly supported Alf Landon, it was very easy for the Democrats to smear Alf Landon as an anti-Semite, guilt by association, or at least the dupe of anti-Semites. Landon was not a particularly successful candidate. He won exactly two states, Maine and Vermont. And that was important. Once upon a time, it was said in America, as goes Maine, so goes the nation. After 1936, they amended that to, as goes Maine, so goes Vermont. if you go back and look in 1936, you'll find that blacks, Catholics, Jews all went strongly for FDR. He wins roughly, about 85% is the usual number 85% of the Jewish vote, which is astounding, really, when you think about it. And then the Jewish love affair with Roosevelt carries on, and this is, of course, much more controversial. It carries on through 1940. It carries on in 1944. The fact that FDR turned away the refugee ship, the St. Louis, and certainly did less than most Jews today think he should have done to save European Jews, to admit fleeing Jews into the United States, to encourage Britain to open up the gates of what was then called Palestine to Jews, that's very important to us. But in 1940 and 44, it mattered less to American Jewish voters than the fact that FDR had saved America from the Great Depression, appointed many Jews to public office, spoke out inspiringly on behalf of American values and freedoms, and led the free world in the battle against Adolf Hitler. There is now, and that's why I'm not going to say more about FDR unless you ask, there's a wonderful book which I commend to you all called FDR and the Jews. It won a big award by Brightman and Lichtman. And that, I think, is the best of all the books on this difficult subject and the most fair-minded, giving both sides of FDR, and also reminding us that the FDR of 1932 and 1936 is different than FDR as you move forward and why that was. But it is worth remembering, Jews were smitten with FDR, and to oppose him in this period was to commit heresy. Rabbi Noam Tzion brought to my attention that in 1941, the father of the great rabbi and professor Arthur Hertzberg in Baltimore urged his congregants to protest, to demonstrate against the treatment of refugees so that more might be admitted, and his congregants fired him. That's a reminder of how Jews felt. For our purposes, which is really the politics, I want to underscore that FDR really puts together this political coalition that embraces Jews as insiders and as key members of his voting bloc. And even though his acolytes, even Stephen Wise, say that they support FDR as an American and not as a Jew, by this time nobody really believes it. It's just paying lip service to those commandments. I think more correct, one of the great lines about American Jewish life in that era was articulated by a Jewish judge named Jonah Goldstein, and he argued that support for FDR had really become part of the religion of American Jews. Jews, he said, believed, you need to know a little Yiddish, in drei Welten, in three worlds. They believed in this world, in dieser Welt. They believed in the next world, in jener Welt. And they believed in Roosevelt. You got it. And they did. FDR is figures are disputed until Professor Weisberg came along. We used to say that in 1940 and 44, he only says 44, 90% of Jews, 90% voted for FDR. When was the last time 90% of Jews agreed on anything? It's astonishing. And Jews then join in the nationwide sense of mourning. It's worth going back to look at it because given that FDR is not nearly so popular in the Jewish world today, it's fascinating to see the mourning rituals, the mourning books that are published when FDR died of a cerebral hemorrhage on April the 12th, 1945, just after he was reelected for the fourth time. Now, Roosevelt's successor, who becomes a president at that moment, was Harry Truman. And Harry Truman has the distinction of being the very first president who actually had done business, had gone into business with Jews. Back in 1919, Truman and a World War I buddy of his named Eddie Jacobson, who was a Lithuanian Jew, who at that time lived on the Lower East Side, formed Truman and Jacobson Haberdashery in Kansas City. I'm sorry?
We're from Kansas City. We're really...
Oh, well, that's why I put all the Kansas City stuff in. I knew you'd be in the front row. 104 West 12th Street. It's not there anymore. 12th Street is, but not the Haberdashery. Actually, the Haberdashery was a terrible failure. It went bankrupt in a couple of years, and they both lost a lot of money. Truman spent years paying off his debts, and Jacobson really never was a business owner again. But they did remain in touch, Jacobson and Truman, and that will be very important. We should note that Mrs. Truman didn't like Jews and didn't like Jacobson very much either, and Jews were not admitted into the Truman home. That was quite common in that period. Who crossed your threshold was one thing. Who you did business with was another. Very frequently, Jews could belong to the city club, but not belong to the country club, because there was a distinction in people's minds between who you admitted to your house and who you did business with. Aside from Jacobson, Jews did not play a huge role in the career of Harry Truman. But, of course, the minute he becomes president, two immensely important issues of very great significance to Jews dominate his foreign policy and foreign agenda. The first was the so-called displaced persons. Displaced persons read largely Jews, Jewish refugees and survivors from Europe. That was one. And the second issue, of course, was the fate of the land of Israel, what they called Palestine. Truman, in a famous passage in his private diary, only discovered decades after his presidency, expressed impatience with Jews. He calls them very selfish. But when you look not at his private jottings, but at his actions, most people think he acquitted himself very well. I'm of the opinion that the actions of presidents are more important than their private thoughts. The famous example there is Richard Nixon, who didn't think much of Jews at all, but he saved Israel during the Yom Kippur War, notwithstanding what we know from his tapes and his private letters. In any case, under Truman, conditions for Jews in the displaced persons camps really radically changed for the better. There was a famous report by General Harrison that criticized America's treatment of the DP, saying it wasn't much better than what the Nazis had done. Very shocking language, which got everyone's attention. Said it wasn't much better than the Nazis, except it wasn't killing Jews. But otherwise, the conditions were horrendous, and Truman takes that to heart, and conditions for Jews are transformed. Rabbis are brought in, And then the DP camps are closed down within a few years. They resettle the Jews in America, in Israel, other places. When it came to what they called the Palestine question, we see Jews in Truman's day taking the political initiative. And really, they take the, we said last time, in the 1930s, Jews were quite hesitant about taking the initiative against in to help Jew their fellow Jews in Europe for immigration and the like. And now, after World War II, Jews are more willing to take the political initiative, I think more than at any time since the abrogation of the Russian Treaty and the great debate back in the early 20s over immigration restriction. We see Jews really trying to shape national politics on an issue critical to the Jewish community. Now, in the background, you have to know, what will probably not surprise some of you, that the State Department vigorously opposed the creation of a Jewish state. And a lot of Zionist leaders feared, I think with good reason, that President Truman would not live up to the 1947 partition resolution of the United Nations. And therefore, because of this great fear that notwithstanding the resolution, the state would not come into existence, Chaim Weizmann, the great leader, Zionist leader, believed that he personally needed to go and lobby President Truman. He felt that he could persuade the president to keep his word, support partition, and recognize the Jewish state when it was created, and he didn't think anybody else would succeed in doing the job. For those who wonder, why not Stephen Wise? I remind you that Stephen Wise at this point is dying of cancer, so is largely out of the picture. Jewish leaders in America agreed. Weizmann is very famous. Let's let him speak to President Truman. And I would say that this is what we might call the traditional politics of shtadlanut. We need an intercessor who will help us, rather different than the politics of power in a democracy where you basically go and say, I represent millions of votes and lots of money to your party and, you know, it's owed to us. That's not what they did. They used a much more traditional political method. The truth is, Truman had become deeply annoyed by all the different Jewish representatives clamoring to influence him. Then, as now, there was no single Jewish organization that represented all the Jews. There were instead a lot of different organizations, each one claiming that they represented all the Jews, and each one insisting that they had to meet the president. Later, we'll have the conference of presidents of major American Jewish organizations. America is an amazing country. There are no minor Jewish organizations. It's astonishing. That has not yet come into existence. And even then, it only lasts and only has power for a few years. Today, in some ways, we're back to the situation in the 40s of a lot of different organizations claiming that they really speak for everybody. So Truman is angry. he absolutely ignores all requests, and he rails in his diary against the, quote, extreme Zionists who were not leaving him alone. The Boston Jewish business executive, Dewey Stone, who had been a very strong supporter of Truman and also was a good friend of Weizmann. Stone, someone should do a book on Stone, but Stone was really an early Jewish democratic power broker. He was despondent in 1947. How can we break through to the president who is so adamant? And according to the story, he, meaning Stone, was honored along with the national president of B'nai B'rith, a man named Frank Goldman, at the Parker House Hotel in downtown Boston. I have to get in a little Boston, can't all be Kansas City. Seeing Stone so downcast, Goldman asks him what's wrong. Stone explains, and Goldman replies that he's just been in Kansas City giving an award to Eddie Jacobson, the president's former store partner. Maybe, said he, Jacobson could persuade his old partner, Harry Truman, to meet with Weizmann. And at least according to the story was widely publicized by Abba Eban. It was one of his favorites. The way Eban would tell it, they went around collecting nickels and dimes at the Parker House because in those days there were telephones that required nickels and dimes. That'll be hard for some people to remember. And they collected all of these dimes and quarters and so on from everyone in attendance. They went to a phone in the Parker House. They made a call to Eddie Jacobson. Eddie Jacobson was a simple Jew, not a great Zionist, but he did like getting so much attention. And he agreed to help. He at once meets with Weizmann. Anyone who met with Weizmann was apparently charmed by him, came under his spell, and having been properly tutored by Weizmann, he then goes to see his friend Harry Truman, and of course, Truman always made time for his old Kansas City buddies. There are various accounts of this meeting. They all agree that the meeting wasn't going very well until Jacobson spied a bust of Andrew Jackson, who was one of Harry Truman's heroes, in the Oval Office. And he is said to have told Truman that Dr. Weizmann was a national leader cast in the same mold and temperament as the great Tennessee president whom Harry Truman revered. Now, I have to tell you, it is hard to imagine two more dissimilar figures than the frontiersman Andrew Jackson and the urbane chemist Dr. Chaim Weizmann. But it worked. What can I say? According to all the accounts, it worked. And Truman told Jacobson that he would meet Weizmann the next week. That's how you get into the history books. Nobody would ever remember Eddie Jacobson. But for that, there is a rabbinic statement. You can win your name in the world to come in 1 hour. And this was Eddie Jacobson's hour. He meets on March the 8th. He meets with Weizmann in March of 1948. The resolve of Truman is strengthened. And according to the story, that's when Truman resolved to recognize Israel when the British departed. And it's an interesting story because it's very much an old world story. You get the right intercessor. The court Jew knows who to turn, knows how to get in when nobody else can, and he uses what I guess here in Israel would be called protectia, to accomplish his goal and help the Jewish people. Historians who are a cynical bunch are not sure it was quite that simple. There's little doubt that Truman had other reasons for being angry. At the State Department, there's a long history down to our day of presidents and the State Department being in tension with one another. I'm not sure the State Department would have picked as its first choice Mr. Friedman to be the ambassador here in Jerusalem. We didn't begin to understand events then. Also, we're talking about an election year, and there's little, and an election that a lot of people thought Harry Truman was going to lose. So there's little doubt that that too was on his mind. But on the fateful day of May the 14th, 1948, when David Ben-Gurion, the fifth of Iyar, gaveled the Jewish state, the State of Israel, into existence, Truman shocked his own advisors and diplomats and personally announced that the United States was extending its recognition to the State of Israel. His UN ambassador was sure that that was a mistake. I ran out to make a telephone call and so on. This was, I would say, the greatest political victory for the organized American Jewish community since the abrogation of the Russian treaty that we talked about last time. And indeed, they knew it. Hundreds of Washington area Jews turned out and sang a tikva, according to the story, and so forth. Thomas Dewey, who, as I said, was the Republican running against Harry Truman and expecting to win, did announce that he, too, supported the State of Israel. But Truman won the Jewish vote. He doesn't win quite as many votes as Roosevelt got, but he gets more. You can see it on your chart here. He gets trying to see where it went to here. Did it get? Yeah, there it is. 75, really only to 10. For Dewey. Once again, a lot of Jews voted for the progressive. In that case, it was Wallace, and that had some factor in the election. The FDR coalition in 1948 held, even without the pixie dust of President Roosevelt, and that coalition continues to hold in the ensuing years. Since FDR and Truman, every single Democratic candidate who has run for president, and except for one person, every single Democrat who has run for president since FDR has received two-thirds or more of the Jewish vote in the United States. Anyone know who the exception was? Jimmy Carter. Yeah. The exception was Jimmy Carter, who didn't get even half of the Jewish vote. And usually his perceived hostility towards Israel is explained as the reason why. In political circles, everybody remembers that Carter was a one-term president, and if you haven't paid attention to Jimmy Carter, let me tell you, he never forgave the Jewish community for that defeat. In that year in 1980, when Carter ran, lots of Jews voted for a third-party candidate named John Anderson. Another person who you can see, if we're talking about how the Jewish community historically responded to people it thought were not sufficiently supportive of Israel. The first George Bush, George H. Bush, Bush the elder, lost lots of Jewish votes for the same reason. And President Obama, in his second election, dropped 9 points from 78% of the Jews to 69%, and that too is often explained on the basis of Israel. Now, if you look at this chart, you'll see some interesting things. Some Republicans, like Ronald Reagan, are more popular with Jews than others. So, for example, and it's a surprise, you might imagine Barry Goldwater, who was of Jewish heritage, would have done better. Barry Goldwater, yeah, Harry Golden, the famous humorist, said that year that he always knew the first Jewish president would be an Episcopalian. Jews, like a lot of Americans, and that's the other time 90% of Jews are supposed to have been Democrats that year. If you look just at the last 25 years, Republicans have only once won more than a quarter of the Jewish vote, and the person who won more than a quarter of the Jewish vote was George Romney in 2012, who won about 30% of the Jewish vote. This past year, just a month ago, and Mr. Trump won about 24%. That's what these are all estimates. It's not like you sign up by religion when you vote. People look at heavily Jewish districts and they do fancy calculations. And as you know, the fancy calculations are always right. But that's the best we can do. And all of these folks argue that 24% of Jews voted for Mr. Trump. The interesting thing is that when people poll Jewish voters, they still tell pollsters that Israel plays a comparatively minor role in whom they vote for. Domestic policies, Jewish values, they insist, count far more. Some people say this reflects those old commandments when people ask you, I don't vote as a Jew, I vote as an American, I vote on my values, and so on. Other people say, no, actually, this reflects some distancing from Israel, and we should take seriously what people say. In any case, since World War II, American Jews have been absolutely consistent in preferring liberal candidates to conservative ones. And the amazing thing is that even as the standard of living, the money, the power of the Jewish community has risen, Jews now earn on a level of America's most fortunate citizens, they've tended to vote with the least fortunate Americans. There was an old line that Milton Himmelfarb popularized, which was that Jews earn like wasps and vote like Puerto Ricans. Nobody uses that line anymore, and the reason is simple. The Puerto Ricans became much more Republican over time, and the Jews still vote more like, today, more like African Americans than like the Anglo-Saxon Protestants or America's wealthy. Now, you may wonder, and this applies really to all four of these lectures, as America's Jewish population actually falls as a percentage of the population, American Jews are less than 2% of America's population. I hear there's a program on Israel television about the disappearance of American Jews. I'm hoping they wait and let me finish out as professor of American Jewish history before they fully disappear. And I will remind you there are more Jews, according to all the counts, than there were 10 years ago. But anyway, Jews certainly have fallen below 2%. Why do people pay attention to the Jewish vote? And I think there's some good reasons why. First of all, Jews actually turn out and vote in high numbers. According to some studies, 85% of all Jews vote in presidential elections. I didn't see a number for 2016. If someone has it, let me know. But I doubt that it fell much. And therefore, Jewish voters matter more than those people who don't go to the trouble of going out and vote. Yeah, 90% of life is showing up. And that's one reason. Second reason is Jews contribute to political parties in very substantial amounts, both the Democrats and the Republicans totally disproportionately rely on Jewish contributors, and that was certainly true in 2016. The largest contributors to Hillary Clinton were Jews, and the largest Republican contributor was also a Jew, Sheldon Adelson. And this goes back a very long time. If you don't like Sheldon Adelson, I heard something. It was true of Max Fisher, who was often one of the largest donors to the Republicans in earlier decades and has interesting things to say about that in his autobiography, believing Jews should be on both sides. Third, Jews happen to live in states that any successful candidate wants to carry in a presidential election. About 85% of Jews live in 20 metropolitan areas of great importance. The four states with the largest Jewish community, California, New York, Florida, New Jersey, that's 128 electoral votes out of 270 needed to win an election. And Jews also live in historically swing states, Florida, Ohio, Pennsylvania. You might notice those all swung in a particular direction in 2016. But those are the swing states, and they all have significant numbers of Jews. Since elections can be very close, witness this year, no party wants to alienate any block of voters, so both parties pursue the Jewish vote. Any of you have lived in Florida, you see that. Every election, every 4 years, you see more than, say, Massachusetts, where the Republicans don't bother. So what happened, and then we'll end. I had promised I'd say something about this election. This is kind of instant history. What happened in 2016? The most interesting development from a Jewish perspective is certainly the fact that both candidates had Jewish sons-in-law. That is an unprecedented development that reflects enormously important changes in American and in American Jewish life. On the one hand, it reflects the impact of intermarriage. On the other hand, it reflects Jewish acceptance into the families of the American political elite. Yes, at one point, Leon Wieseltier called the 2016 election the Battle of the Machatonim. No less interesting is the fact that while many blocks of voters shifted to the Republican Party this year, most famous, the white working class, so important to FDR, or other blocks of voters, contrary to what was expected, barely changed their historic voting patterns. That's true of Hispanics. Or still other voters stayed home and didn't vote in nearly the same numbers as they had in 2012, and that, of course, is the African Americans. Jews, almost uniquely as a group, shifted significantly more of their votes away from the Republican Party and towards Hillary Clinton. In other words, she wins almost three quarters of the Jewish vote, while Donald Trump saw his share of the Jewish vote drop from Romney's 30% to his 24%. Hillary Clinton represented a policy mix that Jews actually have traditionally liked, projecting American strength internationally, promoting liberal policies domestically, education, all of her approach, very cerebral. Jews tended to like that. Bill Clinton was immensely popular in American Jewish circles. He won 80% of the Jewish vote. He also was very popular here in Israel. So one of the surprises for me is that only 74% of American Jews voted for Hillary Clinton, fewer than voted for Bill Clinton. And it is notwithstanding the opponent. This to me is another indication of a slow shift in American Jewish voting patterns. Orthodox Jews are now, their numbers are growing in the United States, and they're predominantly Republican. Russian-speaking Jews, meaning Russian immigrants and their children, lean Republican. When you look abroad, Canada, England, France, Australia, Jews have shifted their loyalties in more conservative directions, largely in the face of liberal attacks on Israel. And there are lots of smart people who think that that's going to happen in the United States as well. Hastening that trend is the fact, nobody knows if it will truly happen, and everyone is interested to see who wins the battle to chair the Democratic Party, but the more radical wing of the Democratic Party, Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Keith Ellison, that is in the ascendancy. The argument is a centrist Democrat cannot win. And the more radical wing of the Democratic Party has tended to be less supportive of Israel and less internationalist generally than, say, recent Democrats have been. The point of all of that is that, and historians, I have to say, are better at the past than the future, but politically liberal Jews may have to choose between their domestic agendas, where they're more sympathetic to the Democrats, and their commitment to Israel. And especially since 1967, owing much more to the evangelical vote, which is huge, than to Jews, Republicans have tended to be more staunch in their support of Israel and somewhat closer to Israel's leadership. So if all of that is right, we'll see a more divided Jewish vote, one that's more similar to 19th century patterns, when nobody assumed that all Jews were one party or the other, and there were shifts, as you've seen in these lectures. That's why I talked about 1896 last time, back and forth, and somewhat less similar to the pattern we've seen from 1928 until the present. Now, once upon a time, no responsible person in Jewish life would have spoken so openly about the Jewish vote as I've done this evening and over this past 4 weeks. I violated and cast doubt on all of those four commandments that we began with 4 weeks ago. And indeed, our very discussion of Jewish political behavior would, in my own memory, have been seen as a shanda. That's a technical term. a communal secret best confined to closed-door discussion. Publicly, you would have expected me to proclaim that Jews only vote as Americans, just like everybody else, and that indeed there is no Jewish vote, and there should be no Jewish vote. I don't think anybody believes that anymore. The role of religion in American public life, the voting patterns of different ethnic and religious groups today can be spoken about openly, not just in the United States, but as you can see, here in Jerusalem as well. I've enjoyed sharing what I know with you over these past weeks, and now it's time for your questions and comments. Thanks very much.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.